Last Sabbath, I spoke about the greatest sin as the violation of the greatest commandment, supreme love for God. And as you know, this has reference to the first four commandments, for Christ simplified the law into just two commandments. Then last Sabbath, we began a series of studies on the last six commandments. We talked about the worth of a human being, the value of man. How much better is a man than a sheep, Jesus asked. We'll be continuing this series on the last six commandments from time to time. War and peace is really on the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. Is it not? And all the conflicts that we have today on the controversy about war and peace relates to the sixth commandment. Did you know that? And all the answers to the problems about the controversy today of war and peace is answered in the sixth commandment. It's that simple. There are many things answered in the last six commandments. Human relations, the race problem, all answered there. Is it not? In fact, you'll discover as you study the commandments better and from a different perspective than we often view it, that today every answer for every modern problem relating to human beings is answered in the Ten Commandments of God. They're all there. If we understood the principles outlined in the Ten Commandments, we would have no trouble understanding where we should stand on all modern issues. No problem whatsoever. It's our lack of understanding about the law of God and our lack of its understanding of its principles, the correct understanding of them, that causes confusion with some modern issues that we see today. And so I hope to go back and look at modern issues relating to human beings and the problems today as you would view them from the Ten Commandments, and especially the last six. As a little interjection in the study of those commandments and modern-day issues that we're having on Sabbath, it's tonight's study, and it actually is on last day events. But it's on the law of God, and I wish you to see the direction we're headed so far as the spirit of prophecy and the Bible are concerned. Most that I give you tonight will be quotations of the spirit of prophecy. For as a Seventh-day Adventist, you're identified with the spirit of prophecy. And all the predictions there are part of the predictions of your church. And you're branded with them whether you want it or not. The only way you can get rid of the brand is to leave the Seventh-day Adventist church. Did you know that? You can try to escape the brand of the spirit of prophecy of Seventh-day Adventist, but it belongs to us. And her books are all in the Library of Congress, and everybody knows about it, and so whatever she's said is about you and me. Is it not? And it's part of our church, whether you like it or not. It's there. And so I'd like to read some of the things she's mentioned about the law of God and what we can anticipate in the very near future. To many of you, it's nothing new, but I think we need the reminder. Now, from our understanding of the Bible and the spirit of prophecy, great things are going to happen in reference to the law of God. And I'd like you to see the studies we're having on Sabbath from week to week in the perspective of what is about to happen and what is transpiring already in reference to this law. In the book Great Controversy, page 22, and I wish you'd write down the quotations and go home and read for a little bit, for the words there are very, very strong and almost exaggerated, you would think, except that God does not inspire people to exaggerate. Jesus looking down to the last generation. Could you reduce the volume just a little bit, Jerry? It's ringing down here in the front. You can't hear it back there. Jesus, looking down to the last generation, saw the world involved in a deception similar to that which caused the destruction of Jerusalem. The world involved in a deception similar to that which caused the destruction of Jerusalem. The great sin of the Jews was their rejection of Christ. The great sin of the Christian world would be their rejection of the law of God. The great sin of the Jews that caused the destruction of Jerusalem was their rejection of Christ, the Messiah. The great sin of the Christian world would be their rejection of the law of God, the foundation of his government in heaven and earth. The precepts of Jehovah would be despised and set at naught. This is what will happen. Looking down the last generation, Jesus saw the world involved in a deception similar to that which caused the destruction of Jerusalem. The rejection of the law. And we understand it's now taking place. In View and Herald articles, December 18th, 1888, and it's also found in that book, The Coming Crisis, by Elder Wilcox, if you have that old book now out of print. It says, the time is coming when the law of God is, in a special sense, to be made void in our land. And the law of God, in a special sense, is to be made void in our land. The rulers of our nation will, by legislative enactments, enforce the Sunday law, and thus God's people will be brought into great peril. When our nation, in its legislative and councils, shall enact laws to bind the consciences of men in regard to their religious privileges, enforcing Sunday observance, and bring oppressive power to bear against those who keep the seventh-day Sabbath, the law of God will, to all intents and purposes, be made void in our land, and national apostasy will be followed by national ruin. Remember the prediction about what happened to Jerusalem when they rejected Christ? Similar things will happen to the Christian world when they reject the law of God. It's a similar thing that's taking place. So when we make void the law of God by the transaction of human enactments to take the place of the fourth commandment, then to all intents and purposes we make void in our land the law of God. National apostasy will be followed by national ruin. I suppose I need to remind you that it's been over 10 years now since the Supreme Court of the United States decreed that business Sunday laws are constitutional. It's been quite some time since they had something to say about prayers in public schools in the early 60s, 1960s, and immediately following that, the first year after, I think 1963, there were 97 proposed amendments to the Constitution to change that idea about religion in schools, which would also change the idea about business Sunday laws and make religious Sunday laws permissible. Last year, I believe there were 70-some proposed in Congress of the United States to change that amendment, the Constitution, about religious freedom. If your eyes are open and your ears, and you're aware that we're marching on to the time of national Sunday laws, then you're very much aware that great things are happening in this respect. Very rapid things. Faster than you can even think, it seems like. They're making strides toward national Sunday laws. And of course, when this happens, it says, then national ruin will come to our country because we are indulging in national apostasy. We've made void the law of God by doing this. In the 119th Psalm and the 126th verse is a text which the Spirit of Prophecy applies to that time, written way back there so many centuries ago. It says, it is time for thee, Lord, to work. 119th Psalm, the longest chapter in the Bible, the 126th verse. It is time for thee, Lord, to work, for they have made void thy law. When they make God's law useless, empty, vain, by the enactments of men, David said under inspiration, it's time for God to work. When that happens, God must go to work. He must do something about that, about man's ideas of law, of God's law. Now, this will become so prevalent, this disregard of God's law. And what we see today are just overtures, not the real thing. For they're marching on very rapidly. And in some of the questions and statements that you hear nowadays and actions, we're seeing how quickly men can come to disregard the law of God. In Adventist Commentary, Volume 3, page 1153, it says, because it, meaning God's law, is made void by the great majority of those living on the earth, shall the few loyal ones become like all the disloyal and act as the wicked act, because the great majority will make void the law of God. The great majority of those living on the earth. So there'll be a very small minority who remain loyal. And she asks, will those loyal ones even come to act like the wicked? Because so many disregard the law of God, will the loyal ones come and act like they do too, feeling that if the majority does it, well, I might as well do it? The thinking of many Christians today and many Adventists is whatever the majority does is right. In a government like ours, a democracy, majority rules. And so many assume that if most do certain things, then I can do those same things. Jesus said the way that leads to destruction is broad, and the majority, or many, find it. The way that leads to life eternal is narrow, and few there be that find it. If you follow the majority, you're on the way to destruction, even the majority in God's church. The way of the minority, and you'll have to choose that way, are the ones who find life eternal. If you're going to let majority dictate to you what you ought to do, you're not on the narrow way. Definitely. But many have that philosophy today. Many dress the way they do because the majority dresses that way. Many indulge in worldly entertainment the way they do because the majority does it that way. Majority of pastors or majority of workers or majority of members in that church or whatever it be. And this is our logic. Majority rules in a democracy. God is not operating a democracy. He is not. God is the supreme authority for all his people. And whatever he says of thus saith the Lord is the way we're to live. And all true Christians believe that. There is one authority. There's one ruler. There's one leader. Isn't that right? And it's not what the people decide, it's what God decides. It's not what the people do, it's what God asks us to do. This is the way of life eternal. We follow him because our ways are in error, you see, because we're sinners, because we do not know the way. We're wandering sheep, lost. We need him to show us the way. He's the shepherd. In volume 6 of the commentaries, page 1081, when the defiance of God's law is almost universal, God will interpose. So first of all, the majority will go that way. Then the defiance of God's law will be almost universal in page 1081, volume 6 of the commentaries. Volume 5 of the testimonies, 524. This crisis will be reached when the nations shall unite in making void God's law. When the nations shall unite. So be the majority, almost universal, and the nations unite. Not just one country, but the nations uniting. Volume 5 also says, every nation on earth will follow our example in passing National Sunday Law. So you see, it's the majority, an enormous majority, that decide that they ought to oppose God's law. Well, they don't call it that, of course. They do this by transacting a law in opposition to God's law. To understand the sides in the issue, you must read on a little bit more, because some people so misunderstand God's law that they do not understand why a National Sunday Law would be so bad. But you must begin to see the sides as they're depicted in Great Controversy, page 582. 582, Great Controversy. The last great struggle between truth and error is but the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. The last great struggle between truth and error is but the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Way, way back, when they discussed the creation of this world, and Satan became jealous, the controversy started over the law of God. Satan said that no one could keep God's law. And the last struggle will be on that very same point. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah. The last struggle, now we're talking about, between truth and error, will be over the law of God. Upon this battle we're now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah. Between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. The laws of men, the laws of God, religion of the Bible, and the religion of tradition and fable. These are the sides. In other words, men will rise up to the place where they are presumed to be greater than God, because they will change their God's law and ask men to honor men's laws. So man, the created, assumes that he's mightier than the creator. And he will tell God what to do. The anti-establishment trend that we see today will enlarge to such proportions that they'll become anti-God in the transaction of a law contrary to his law. So human laws in contradiction of the laws of God. Page 763 of Desire of Ages talks about the same thing. 763, Desire of Ages. By substituting human law for God's law, and it's repeated many places, by the way, in that page about three times, by substituting human law for God's law, Satan will seek to control the world. This work is foretold in the prophecy, Daniel 7:25, where it says he'll think to change times and laws. She quotes it right there. It's prophesied right there, she said. By substituting human law for God's law, Satan will seek to control the world. It's foretold in Daniel 7:25. Continues on, men will surely set up their laws to controvert the laws of God. They will surely do this. And continuing on, all will be called to choose between the law of God and the laws of men. All, every human being, will have to choose between the laws of God and the laws of men. You say, well, that'll be easy for me. Is it easy for you now? Is it easy for you now to choose between the laws of men and the laws of God? If what God asks us to do is contrary to what most people do, what do you do? In what we call minor matters, what do you do? Do you do what most people do, or what God would have you do? Or do you come along and say, I'm not so sure the Lord said that? Or I think times have changed and he's changed his mind about these times. And you know all the rest of the answers we can dream up for following the ways of men rather than the ways of God. And the more we follow the ways of men, the easier it is to follow them when we come to major issues, such as the law of God being at stake. So all will be called to choose between the law of God and the laws of men. In volume 7 of the Testimonies, page 141, it says, the substitution of the laws of men for the law of God, the exaltation by merely human authority, the substitution, first of all, the laws of men for the law of God, and then she describes another way, the exaltation by merely human authority of Sunday in the place of the Bible Sabbath is the last act in the drama. When this substitution becomes universal, God will reveal himself. The unique thought there is the exaltation by merely human authority. Seventh-day Adventists are not invulnerable to adherence to human authority. In fact, I've heard many a discussion on theology and different doctrines and teachings and difficult texts in which you say, and I have said, and others say, but Elder so-and-so said this. You didn't say the Bible said this. You don't say the Spirit of Prophecy says this. You say Elder so-and-so said this. What difference does it make what a human being says? Unless he's inspired of God. Unless God has chosen him in a unique way. What difference does it make? What does the Bible say? What saith the Lord? And these days we come to trust more and more and more what men say. Now the Bible tells us we ought to listen when God's men speak, but we ought to go home and do something about it. What's that? To find out these things are true. That's right. We ought to go home after men speak and discover whether these things be true or not. He commended the Bereans because they did that. We need to go home and search the books ourselves, don't we? And find out for ourselves if God really says that. And we don't accept what men say, we accept what God says. And when men speak to us, we say, that's fine, I'll go home and read it, just what you say. And Paul said, I thank God that when they heard us speak, they received us the words of God, not of men. But they went home and checked it out, didn't they? Went back to check it out. And so we're not to quote what men say, we're supposed to find it out for ourselves. And then we find out for ourselves, we're going to say, God said this. And we can point out the scriptures, the quotations of the Spirit of Prophecy. But these days, you know, we're so prone to neglect Bible study because it's difficult to find it there, and the Spirit of Prophecy because there are so many books. And remember what a man says and quote him. And it's amazing today how, especially in centers of learning, we're prone to follow the teachings of men. And we've come to the place where we follow so many teachings of so many men that we cannot tell when the men are departing from the scriptures. That's a fact. We cannot tell. Someone just spoke to me a few days ago about the teachings of a certain man. And I listened very, very carefully. And it appears to me, as I have examined the teachings of that man very recently, that he's saying something that's different than the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy teach. It seems to me that way. I'm amazed that we're so prone to take it because it sounds good, or it sounds right, or we like what they say, or something like that. But that doesn't prove it. That doesn't make it from God. We must be very careful that we do not begin to exalt merely human authority. That is not enough. For men will bring the deceptions that will cause the destruction of God's law. They try to take it away, you see. It says in page 234 of volume 9 of the Testimonies, they will try to compel men to obey the laws of their own creation, laws that are directly opposed to the law of God, to try to compel us to obey the laws of their own creation, our own making, and that are directly opposed to the law of God. On page 229 to 30 of volume 9 of the Testimonies, 229 to 30, volume 9 of the Testimonies. The previous quotation is page 234. Men will exalt and rigidly enforce laws that are in direct opposition to the law of God. They'll exalt and rigidly enforce them. Though zealous in enforcing their own commandments, they'll turn away from a plain, thus saith the Lord. They'll be zealous in enforcing their own, but turn away from a thus saith the Lord. Exalting a spurious rest day, they will seek to force men to dishonor the law of Jehovah, the transcript of his character. All will be required to render obedience to human edicts in violation of the divine law. I just wish you'd mull that over for a little while. You have to think about it. Can you imagine such opposition to God as to exalt something that men devise, sinners devise, and pit this against God's law and require men to obey God while calling themselves Christian? For this will not be a non-Christian person in the world doing it, will it? Not at all. These will be Christians. They'll call themselves Christians. In fact, those who will not do what they ask them to will be called non-Christian. You'll be termed those who hate God. And so it'll come down to such a degree, you see, as this, that those who profess strong Christianity will ask us to violate what God requires us to do. And they will say those who not go their way are non-Christian. And even though they should be destroyed, they'll be compelled to do this. Now, how can people be so deceived as to do that? How can Christian, enlightened, intelligent, educated people do such a thing? How is it possible? You see, we assume that we're safe because we keep the Sabbath, because we know the dead are dead, because we have the truth, quotes. So we're safe. I don't believe that at all. I do not believe those things make us safe. They should make us safe, but we should go on from there and not stop there and just rest assured everything is all right. How do we get that deceived? How are they that deceived? So they accept human laws in the place of God's law and enforce them that way. Great Controversy, page 573. 573, Great Controversy. It is a spirit of the papacy, a spirit of conformity to worldly customs. A spirit of conformity to worldly customs. The veneration for human traditions above the commandments of God. Are you listening? The spirit of conformity to worldly customs, the veneration for human traditions above the commandments of God that is permeating the Protestant churches and leading them on to do the work of Sunday exaltation, which the papacy has done before them. Two things that trap them: veneration for human tradition above the commandments of God, and the spirit of conformity to worldly customs. You see, if I have become accustomed to what the majority do, if I can see nothing wrong in what the world does or many things the world does, so I conform routinely, regularly, after a while, what the world does cannot be wrong. And you're hearing that from thousands of voices today, even the Adventist Church. What the world does cannot be wrong. That's what we're hearing. We hear this is right, that's right, this is right, that's right. Even some of the theology now of the world is being advocated by Seventh-day Adventist ministers. Haven't you heard it? Some of that theology is being advocated. So there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, they say it's like the spirit of prophecy. It's very similar. And they even give you some quotation in the spirit of prophecy to show you how right some worldly theologians are. So as you accept this conformity to worldly customs and veneration of human traditions over the commandments of God, you gradually get in step, you know, lockstep, until finally when they pass these human laws that are contrary to God's law, you say, that's fine. That's fine. One thing that causes us to conform to worldly custom is the fear of being different. The word that's used so commonly today is a square. In fact, there's almost nothing more frightening today to old and young than to be a square. It almost puts us into hysteria. It makes us psychotic and paranoid. It does. And we hear so many, many arguments about why do I have to be different? And isn't it a terrible thing to be different? What's so wrong with those people? You must be very exclusive. You must despise them. You must think you're so wonderful by being so different. And they have all kinds of arguments to come along and destroy those who would dare to be different. It used to be a good thing to be different, even among worldly people. The papers and magazines used to exalt those fellows who are very independent and even eccentric sometimes. And Einstein surely was not a conformist, was he? Nor was Abraham Lincoln. And you go on and on with hundreds of scientists. None of them are conformists. Not at all. They're all oddballs, if you want to call them that. Very peculiar people. And the Christians were so unique that the Bible spells out the differences about them. Even their language was different. Isn't that right? So many things about them were different. And Seventh-day Adventists used to be different. They used to be. It's hard to tell the difference nowadays of many of them. And some people think this is a good thing, a very good thing. They say they shouldn't be so different. And the thing they're opposed to is the exclusive attitude we've had, which is wrong. While we should not be exclusive, it doesn't mean we should conform to worldly custom, does it? Not at all. Nor should we look down on the world. That isn't the thing that's required of us either. We ought to be very humble. But nevertheless, we should not be like them. For the Bible forbids it. It calls it adultery in James. Does it not? And friendship with the world is that. It ought to turn us the other direction. The dangerous things that lead to the deception are conformity to worldly customs and veneration for human traditions. They're the two weaknesses which, if indulged in and followed, they will soon lead us down to where we can accept laws of men in opposition to laws of God. Behind all of this is the work of Satan. Prophets and Kings, page 186. 186, Prophets and Kings. It is Satan himself who inspires such legislation. How he well knows that the curse of God will rest on those who exalt human enactments above the divine, and he does all in his power to lead men into the broad road that ends in destruction. He well knows that the curse of God will rest on those who exalt human enactments above the divine. It is all in his power to lead them on the broad road, you see, that ends in destruction. Behind all of this is someone who doesn't like you. Now, somehow today, following worldly customs has been painted as the way of love, as the way of consideration, compassion, and understanding, as the way of kindness. And the way of God's law has been painted to us, and Adventists even think this way, as the way of restriction and confinement and dislike and lack of love and lack of compassion. And even in Adventist homes and schools, it's looked upon in that fashion right now. And somehow we cannot lay all the blame on others. Somehow our young people got in the idea by our teachings that there's something wrong with God's law. They don't like it. And I wouldn't say it's all their fault, because I think we have taught them a very legalistic way sometimes, a pharisaical way. And they have never known the love of Christ that transforms a life and enables them to do what the law requires. And so the law becomes an impossible hurdle that they must jump, and they cannot find the power to jump that high, or they're lost. And since they've tried and failed and tried and failed, they're lost. And they don't like it because they're lost. And we say, try harder. Pray more. Or we think of some new gimmick they ought to try to do it. And they try all the gimmicks and it still doesn't work. And we say, they must not like to do what's right. That's not the answer at all. They do not know how to do what's right. And those who taught them probably didn't know how either. When it comes to doing it from the heart, they might have had a stronger will and could do it on the outside. When it comes from the heart, they probably didn't know how, or they would have taught it to their children or their converts. And so I'm not sure that all this failure and all this attitude is on the part of the one failing. I think much of it is on the part of the teacher sometimes. And I include ministers in that and parents as well. What will happen as a result of bringing this human enactments in opposition to God's law? Volume 5 of the Testimonies, page 524. God keeps a reckoning with the nations. Through every century of this world's history, evil workers have been treasuring up wrath against the day of wrath. And when the time fully comes that iniquity shall have reached the stated boundary of God's mercy, his forbearance will cease. When the accumulated figures in heaven's record books shall mark the sum of transgression complete, wrath will come, unmingled with mercy, and then it will be seen what a tremendous thing it is to have worn out the divine patience. Then it will be seen what a tremendous thing it is to have worn out the divine patience. This crisis will be reached when the nation shall unite in making void God's law. There's another one like it that's a little different. Christ Object Lessons, 177-8. 177-8, Christ Object Lessons.
The world has become bold in transgression of God's law. Because of his long forbearance, men have trampled upon his authority. They have strengthened one another in oppression and cruelty toward his heritage, saying, "How doth God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High?" Quoting Psalm 73:11. But there's a line beyond which they cannot pass. The time is near when they have reached the prescribed limit. Even now, they have almost exceeded the bounds of the long-suffering of God, the limits of his grace, the limits of mercy. The Lord will interpose to vindicate his own honor, to deliver his people, and to repress the swellings of unrighteousness. You see, when you begin to look back and understand that God so loved the world, and all that the world is like, and all that worldlings are like, God so loved them while they're enemies, while they're in that rebellious, sinful condition. He so loved them that he gave his only begotten Son, that they may not perish but have everlasting life. Instead of condemning them for their sins, he said there's therefore now no condemnation to them in Christ Jesus. He came to take it all away in Jesus. He didn't come to point the finger, for God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, John 3:17, but that the world through him might be saved. God has loved the world from the very beginning. God is love. He's loved us with an everlasting love. All the gospel and all the Bible is a description of God's love for sinners, for the world. When the world, in spite of all the demonstration of God's love, all that's written about God's love, all that's sung about God's love, all that's prayed about his love, all that's preached about his love, all that's testified about his love, when the world, in spite of all this, will come along and try to change God's law because they don't like it, it's like spitting in the face of the one who's the kindest person you ever met. And somehow we don't understand that. I read in volume 4 of Adventist Commentary, page 1162, those who trample upon God's authority and show open contempt to the law given in such grandeur at Sinai virtually despise the lawgiver, the great Jehovah. Those who trample on God's authority show open contempt to the law given in such grandeur at Mount Sinai virtually despise the lawgiver, the great Jehovah. I do not know whether you understand what I'm saying. Jesus said, when he was asked the great commandment in the law, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart," you know, don't you? And he said, the second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. The Protestant Christian world today say, we believe in Christ's new law. They've argued Adventists for years about this. They say, we believe that you ought to love God supremely and your neighbor as yourself. That's they say. And so while professing to love God supremely, they change his law. And they put their own in the place of his. And while professing as Christians to love their neighbors themselves, they pass laws that to kill other Christians because they do not agree with them. Is it possible to be more deceived than that? Is it possible? While I profess to love you, I plan to kill you, just like they killed Jesus. While I profess to love God, I change his rules and believe that it's all right. And I think that my rules are showing supreme love for him? Not at all. It can't be. But the Christian world, the great majority, when it becomes universal, will be that deceived. And we say, you know, I won't be that deceived. I won't do that. When Jesus' disciples came to him, Matthew 24, and you know the chapter on the signs, they said to him in verse 3, "Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no man deceive you." The first sign of his coming, the one that's repeated more than all others put together, the one that's emphasized the most, is deception. "Take heed that no man deceive you," he said to his disciples, to his believers, to his followers. "Take heed that no man deceive you." And he pursues it. Verse 5 as you go on there. He said, many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, shall deceive many. Don't believe them. And as you skip on down in that chapter to verse 11, he repeats it again. Then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. Verse 10. Many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. Beware of deception. And as you read on down later in the chapter 23 and 24, then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall rise false Christs, plural, false prophets, plural, shall show great signs and wonders, miracles, in other words, insomuch if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. The very elect themselves. I tell you about this tonight because as I have thought about the sermon I preached 2.5 weeks ago about the greatest commandment, supreme love for God, and as I have thought about the other commandments, honor my father and my mother, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, bear false witness, steal, covet, I can assume that because I do not steal from you that I'm keeping the commandments, you see. But Jesus enlarged those commandments. He said that hatred is murder, didn't he? He described another kind of adultery, too, you know, just the look of an eye. He said the character, the principles of the law, the character of God is to be found in us who love him and follow him. And you know, I'm wondering if I do not deceive myself into thinking that I keep the commandments because I do not do those things. But in spirit, I break them every day. In principle. That while I'm professing to love you greatly, I can criticize you quite severely. That sometimes I can gossip. You don't do that, do you? That sometimes I could even bear false witness when the pressure is on. You know, not a real bad one. One of those little tiny ones that insignificant, that I don't think will hurt anybody until they find out about it. Just in a business deal, just a little twist, you know, I just didn't say it, talk about it. Selling of a car and there's something wrong, but I don't say anything about it. He didn't ask about it. His tough luck. Isn't that right? Or selling of a house and there's just a little something over here, you know, but they'll find out about it after a while. It's not too serious, but they wouldn't have bought the house, perhaps, if I had told them about it. Just all sorts of things. The conference has found out in trust funds sometimes, and I serve in the association, that when people can't get rid of a piece of property, they've had it for years and it's almost worthless, they give it to the conference. Not all, some. And the conference can't get rid of it either. In fact, the conference has to spend more money than it's worth sometimes to get rid of it. And the people tell everyone, I gave so much to the conference. No, you gave a liability to the conference, not an asset. We have some property we had for 10, 12 years we can't get rid of. And those who gave it couldn't get rid of it either. Nobody wants it. But we tell everybody else we gave the Lord a great gift. I'm not sure the Lord thinks that way, you know. As I read Jesus' description of the commandments, supreme love for God and loving my neighbor as myself, I really wonder, you know, do I love you as myself? Do you love one another as your own self? Does God have first place in your heart, in your affections, your interests, your time, your planning, everything? Or is he routinely given the back seat? That when you have indulged in your other interests that are more important, that then if you have time left over, God may have that. If I cannot get along with my spouse, and I know the problems that many, many have this way nowadays, do I really love my neighbors myself? If I can't get along with my children, will I really love my neighbors myself? If I cannot love my father and mother, the Bible recommends that in the commandments, will I really love God supremely and love my neighbors myself? If those who are the closest to me and the most precious, my own flesh and blood, parents, children, spouse, if I cannot love them as myself, how can I possibly love the man next door? Is that too harsh? If such a terrible time is coming, as I read to these quotations, if it's going to become almost universal when men deny the law of God and trust human enactments, if men will be so deceived that by calling themselves Christians and loving God supremely, they'll try to change his law. And professing to love their neighbors themselves, they'll try to persecute their neighbor and still think they're Christian. I belong to the same human family as they belong to. So do you. If they can be deceived, I can be deceived. And Jesus warned even his most intimate followers, take heed that no man deceive you. And I believe he was warning you and me in the same breath, don't you? Is it possible that I today think I love my neighbors myself, and I can't get along with my husband or my wife, or my children, or my parents? How ridiculous. I think the devil laughs at us, don't you? I really believe, you know, that when we come to understand the law of God in its beauty, when we delight in his law, when we find that it's the way of life eternal, that it spares us from thousands of evil, that this is the safe way, this is the way of peace and happiness, this is the way of love and kindness and compassion and understanding and joy, we discover that, and it's not restrictive. It's only restricted from all the pitfalls, all the dangers, all the evil, all the wars. When we discover what it really is like, that it's the character of the God who is love, who is also peace, isn't that right? Who also so loved that he gave his son to die for us. When we discover that, I think we'll go back and realize that those children he's given to us are extremely precious. And perhaps we'll love them. And maybe he'll turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, according to the last chapter of Malachi. And then I think the children, when they discover what that law is really like, their hearts will be turned to the fathers too. Don't you think so? And then I really think that the hearts of husbands and wives will be turned toward each other. And they'll count a blessed privilege that God has endowed me with this wonderful spouse, will stand by my side in all the adversities that I have caused, not that she has caused. Somehow, you know, that law has to come inside of us until self is rooted out and we see the beauty of Jesus living out this self-sacrificing love, this supreme affection for God and love so much for human beings, even his enemies, that he'd die for them. And when I begin to follow in his footsteps, I'm not worried about what my spouse does to me or my children. I'm concerned about what I do to them. I'm not concerned about how you treat me and how many friends I have. I'm concerned about how friendly I am to you and what I do for you. And then I believe with all my heart that when I begin to see that the way of Jesus is the way of the Ten Commandments, that magnificent love which I so desperately need as a sinner, which is my only hope of salvation, that also becomes the hope for my family and the hope for my neighbor. And that the Lord has called me to go forth in these last days when the law is about to be made void in the whole land, he's asked me to go out and demonstrate the marvelous love of God for sinners in the way I treat you. That's what he wants. Paul asked the question, what profit was it to be a Jew in the Old Testament? What advantage do they have? He said, very much, because to them were committed the oracles of God. I read in the Spirit of Prophecy that to Seventh-day Adventists have been committed the Ten Commandments, the oracles of God, that we might live that law of love in all of its beauty. We might so delight in it, find so much peace in it, find so much satisfaction and joy and eternal happiness, so much Christ-likeness, the way of life eternal, that we, to whom it's been committed, will live the kind of life that will truly preach the beauty and holiness of that marvelous law, that men might praise and love Jesus because they see Christ in us as we live the way of Christ described in the law. For he said, I've kept my Father's commandments. If God is to win in this great war, which rages over this one issue, the law of God, somebody must demonstrate, not just speak, the glories, the perfection, the love, the happiness, the peace of God's law. You and I have the privilege. We're called to do the job. To us has been committed.
May God open our eyes to really see the beauties in the law of God, the happiness there, the way of joy and the way of peace and life eternal. And may he grant us, by his grace and power, to live like Jesus every day, so that other people will see the same glory, the same joy, the same peace, the same love. And they will follow him too, and not be in that broad way, the great majority, going to destruction. God is calling upon us to spare them, to save them by the lives we live. May we do a good work for him by his grace and power, is my prayer in Jesus' name. Shall we stand? Loving Father in heaven, straighten out our thinking about God's law. Help us to realize that he didn't come to restrict us from any good thing. He only came to avoid all the pitfalls, all the dangers, all the evil. Who might have happiness, who might have joy, and who might have life and have it more abundantly. Help us to understand that the law is love. The love of God for sinners is found there. Help us to understand that here is found the way to live in peace and harmony with our fellow human beings. And here's the way to serve the Lord supremely. Grant us such a view and a vision, a conviction of the mighty love of God found in the law, that every day of our lives will be found following Jesus, who perfectly obeyed his Father's commandments, that will love him so supremely that every other thing is crowded out of our lives, that will gladly sacrifice, forgetful of self, that we might minister to other human beings, that they might see the way of self-sacrificing love, that we might glorify Christ in all that we do and say. Grant will be about our Father's business, for the enemy, the destroyers at work these days, to come and take away the love of the law, the love of God, the love of Christ. Grant that we'll so understand and so serve him that thousands, tens of thousands, will stand on the Lord's side, that they'll serve him, and that someday he can say to them, because by his grace they served him, well done, good and faithful servant, enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.